morning, Your Honors.
Counsel.
May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
May it please the court, my name is Shane Cochran with Snyder, Hilliard & Cochran here in Kearney. And so we too also appreciate that we get to not have to drive all the way to Lincoln this morning. But this is a case, Your Honors, where it's not a traditional case of parent versus parent. This is a case of parent versus non-biological grandma on mother's side. Biological.
Does it matter whether she's a biological grandparent or not? Is there any case law that makes that
there,
an issue?
The point of this is, yes, in I believe the main case here would be the Combs versus O'Neill, or several of the cases that I've kind of pointed out in my brief that state that anybody who's not a biological parent to the child is considered to be a stranger to the parent-child relationship as it relates to this parental
she's
preference.
She's the adoptive mother. She's the adoptive mother of the mother of the child.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, correct. That is correct. Yes. But in the sense of the parental preference doctrine, she would be considered a stranger to the parent-child relationship, as the case law points out. So when Apelli in their brief states that she stood in loco parenti, and I believe the court found that she did stand in loco parenti, that still does not give her the status of a biological parent as it relates to the parental preference doctrine. And so where we believe that the court erred in this case mainly is in basically claiming that the preferential preference doctrine did not apply simply because my client had a phone call with the biological mother after a very brief relationship in which she had left him with the impression that she was pregnant. There are some factors that go along with that, one of which is that my client was in the reserves at that time. He was being deployed to Iraq, so right before he's getting deployed, he gets a phone call. He was left with the impression that she was pregnant, but based upon their relationship and her general reputation in that area, he was not left with the impression that he would be the father of that child. There were several other options, I believe, for that. When the trial came and she testified, Ms. Pamela Waters, she did testify that she had no idea who the father was, and when the child was born, she didn't put his name on the birth certificate. So there
wasn't
was no
there evidence she wasn't sure what his name was, his given name?
Yes, there was some evidence that she wasn't completely sure who his name was, but when it was clarified on her redirect, she testified that not only did she not necessarily, she wanted to get the name right, but she also wanted to make sure who Dad was. So it is reasonable to assume that if Mom doesn't necessarily know who Dad is, why would Dad know who Dad is at that time either?
But he made no inquiry even upon returning to the States.
He did not. He did not have any contact information for her as well. So he was gone for a period of 1 year. The child would have been already born, and I believe at that time, and I can't make a complete assumption on this, but at least 4 to 6 months old at that time, as far as when he would have come back to the States.
Was there evidence that Mom would have known how to reach him upon his return?
Well, she was able to reach him at least the first time with a phone call, but there was no further phone calls at that point, so she would have had his phone number at least at the time that he was, right before he was deployed. So she would have had that, and then I believe where she actually found him was on Facebook. So there was some evidence that she could have found him through Facebook as well to continue on with that.
Was there any evidence that his phone number had changed from the time he left the States and returned?
I don't believe that that's in the record, Your Honor. I don't believe anybody asked that question, so I don't want to speculate on that, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
Could it have mattered
answer.
If, you know, if he intentionally changed his number so she couldn't reach him? Would that have made a difference here?
Well, certainly if he was attempting to subvert her attempts to get a hold of him, that would have certainly changed. But once, and as further evidence of his not necessarily doing that, once he was finally reached, after the initial shock wore off that he actually had a child in existence, he went ahead and filed, tried to get custody and tried to get some parenting time, went to go meet the child, even with the counselor present, and did kind of a staggering graduated parenting time through the court, where he started out with just being able to see the child at first with grandma's permission, and then going on into a every Saturday visitation with the, or every other Saturday, I apologize, with the, through the court from like a 10 a.m. to a 6 p.m. type thing or 5 p.m. And then a few months after that, graduated up to an every other weekend schedule, where he did then receive some extended Christmas visits. And then right before the trial, he was able to receive a extended summer visit of a few different weeks. So,
is it a problem that the only expert who testified to the fact that the child was not ready to be fully with the father? There was not yet a bond established.
So, while there is, yes, the expert did testify to that, she also, what I think the court didn't take into consideration was that she testified that the child was having a great time at dad's house. There wasn't anything inappropriate going on at dad's house. That not only that, but that the way that you can find out if a child's going to have issues is to try those things, to try the extended visits. So the expert did clarify that she was able to, if when I asked her the question at trial, if you were to give custody to dad and then perhaps give every other weekend to grandma, which is what we had proposed, how would that go about, you know, helping with the child? And she said that it could, if the child knew that she wasn't going to be taken away from grandma completely and grandma cut out of her life, that that could help her to establish the further relationship with dad. And there were other witnesses, certainly that, you know, the court has the ability to basically state that experts kind of give a little more credence to somebody's case than, say, lay witnesses do. But there were other lay witnesses that testified that they were able to see a bond between Mr. Bentley and Macy.
How long had it been between the time he started visiting Macy and the trial?
I believe his very first visit was in March of 2017. Now, he didn't get another visit from that time until a little bit later, but once he started his consistent visits, which I believe were in July of 2017, it would have been a full year from that time until the trial with that progression coming in. And so what we had argued is the natural progression after the every other weekend, every other holiday, because they do live in two separate communities that is a couple hours away from each other, that the next logical progression would be then switch to dad, but still give grandma some time, still give grandma the extended time, still give grandma the every other weekend and that sort of thing.
The district court relied pretty heavily on the Jeffrey B. versus Amy L. Mm-hmm. case. How do you distinguish this case from that case?
In the Jeffrey B. versus Amy L. case, this is a difficult one because in the Jeffrey B. they're asking to be intervention. And that's where I believe the difference lies is the court wasn't necessarily looking at the parental preference doctrine as it relates to should dad have custody of this child. It was looking at should dad have standing when dad knew that there was a child in existence, but then did nothing for the several years, and in fact allowed another dad to be determined to be dad in a I believe at that time it might have been a divorce case, or a separate paternity case. I'm not sure exactly which one that was, but allowed somebody else to be considered to be dad. And so coming in several years after the fact to then try to challenge this already entered court order that has been in existence for several years. I think that's what they were looking at, is does he have the standing to do that? Not necessarily
yeah,
should he have custody.
That the procedural mm-hmm. Posture of the case is different, but the Supreme Court makes some pretty, while Todd slept on his rights, and they really make a point out of him at least having an idea that he could be the father and not acting on that possibility. How is that different than what we have here?
Well, certainly, yes, as far as sitting on your rights, but this for Mr. Bentley, he didn't know that there was a child in existence. He was left with the impression she was pregnant. He was not left with the impression that the child was his. He was gone and then came back. So I don't necessarily consider it sleeping on his rights in that sense. He had no idea. And so coming back to this, it's hard to say that somebody should be able to have to know that and be able to guess not only that their dad, but that their child does exist now. It's in the world, and then you don't receive any word, versus the Jeffrey B. case where he knew the entire time that there was a child. He knew that he could be dad, but never did anything about it. And he still had contact with mom, I believe, throughout that time. So.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Adam Little with the firm Ballew Hazen. I'm here representing the appellee, Ms. Deborah Waters. The case was fairly accurately described by opposing counsel of this as an issue of a biological father versus an adoptive grandmother. And right off the bat, we need to address that issue that you raised, Judge Arterburn, of does it matter if she's not biological? Absolutely not. The district court was correct in determining that she stood in loco parente because she assumed the legal duties of a parent. When the child was born, grandmother was involved throughout the child's life. She routinely would take the child, care for the child's needs, and most importantly, when the child was 3 years old, due to the biological mother having some health issues, she was no longer able to care for the child. The grandmother took over those duties. She also received a power of attorney from her daughter to take care of her child. At that point, unequivocally, Ms. Waters was standing in the place of a biological parent. She was fulfilling all of those duties. He, on the other hand, was absent. He was not involved.
And the issue here is can that absence be considered a forfeiture of his parental rights?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that actually brings me to my very first point, that the district court correctly determined that the parental preference doctrine did not preclude the court from considering placing custody with the grandmother. The parental preference doctrine was really laid out in the Wyndham case in that in a controversy between a biological or adoptive parent and one who is neither a fit or biological adoptive parent has a superior right for custody. But most importantly, this is by definition a preference. There is a presumption in favor of the parental biological parent having custody, but it can be overcome in three scenarios. The first doesn't apply here of unfitness. We all agree they're fit. The second of those three prongs is that a parent forfeited their superior right. The third I'll address after this is that there is a superior right negated by the child's best interests. Now looking at that second prong, Mr. Bentley forfeited his superior rights through his absence during the first 6 years of the child's life. There's some key facts here that really solidify this and the district court properly analyzed. Mr. Bentley was the last person who was sexually active with the biological mother. When she told him that she was pregnant and that she believed he was the father because of him being the person who was sexually active with her, he stated he was confused and said he didn't want a baby. She then tried to communicate with him, but he told her, "I'm being deployed, so don't try to communicate with me." She then tried to call him to notify him of the birth of the child, but she could not get through to him. She made these attempts, but what is most critical in this analysis is that he had knowledge that he likely had a child, or at the very least could have a child, and he did nothing. He decided, "I'm deployed, I don't have to do anything, it'll just go away." And 6 years go by, 6 years where this child didn't have a biological father, 6 years where Miss Waters was the one person who was caring for her and for her best interests. So yes, absolutely, Mr. Bentley abandoned his right to claim that he is a biological parent.
Isn't it problematic that the biological mother did not indicate any father on the birth certificate as though unaware of who the father was?
I don't believe that is problematic, Your Honor. In fact, oftentimes it's fairly common to not indicate a biological father unless you are absolutely certain.
But she actually indicated she wasn't certain. That was one of the reasons she didn't list a father, correct?
I believe at that point, from her perspective, and this is not in the record, this is one we have to kind of draw an assumption from, Unless you are have a DNA test or something to that effect, you don't know. And in addition, based on his conduct and his insistence, he doesn't want a baby, he doesn't want any contact, you can't reach me, I'm gone.
But the only evidence was that she attempted to, she said she tried to call his number one time after that October telephone call.
Right.
And that was it. And it wasn't suggested that that one time even occurred after the child was born, I don't believe. I don't recall
it. Yeah, correct.
So before the child was even born, she claims that she tried to call him one time and didn't reach him. Is there any evidence in the record that after the child was born that she actually tried to contact Mark to let him know that the baby was born and that he should come in? And
I don't believe so. But I don't believe that is fatal to this analysis because it's not the court isn't looking at her conduct. It's looking at Mr. Bentley's conduct. And we believe that the evidence is sufficient to put him on notice that he had a reasonable belief he had a child, and he told her he didn't want
it. So anytime a guy has sex with a woman and the woman calls him later and says, hey, I'm pregnant, that man has an obligation to maintain contact, even if the sexual relationship was a matter of three times, I think, in 1 month, to call back, you know, 9 months later and find out, did you have a baby, and is that baby possibly mine? Is that what the standard is?
I don't believe that's necessary here in its entirety because the issue is that he's coming back and claiming he has a right. And so the issue for him is if he's on notice, he should at the very least follow through on that if he's going to later claim a right. The issue here is looking at his abandonment. And so if he knew at the very least there was a possibility and he did nothing, that I think is the issue.
Is that the standard? Then if anyone has any notion there's a possibility that they may have conceived a child, they have a duty to follow up?
I believe that that should be the case, Your Honor, because if you have a reasonable belief that you may be the father of a child and you choose to do nothing, you are in effect abandoning whatever role you may play as that biological parent.
What's the hardship on the mother notifying the father after the child is born to say, I believe you're the father, you need to come in and be tested? What's the hardship with that?
I don't believe there's much of a hardship here. The issue in this specific case is Mr. Bentley's conduct in saying, I don't want this baby, and I don't want you to contact me. And it's also important to recognize Ms. Waters' state of mind. She, as the record was undisputed that she had some mental health issues, a variety of things.
She had some drug issues.
Correct. And so I think it would be unfair here to place a burden on her when Mr. Bentley is the one seeking the right in this instance.
He's seeking the right once he knew.
Right.
Once he knew the child was actually his child, that's when he wanted to seek the right to be the parent.
Correct. Right? But the critical analysis here is the 6 years that went by where he did nothing. I mean, he could have done something, and I think here placing the burden on mother is unjust in this instance, and the correct district court correctly analyzed that, look, he knew. He had some reason to at least know and just to wait 6 years, and the only reason he did anything is he got served with the court papers when the state filed.
If Mr. Little, if it was purely an equitable decision, everything you're saying makes sense, right? But we have that parental preference doctrine that we have to deal with, and so the issue really becomes, do these facts rise to that level of forfeiture? And if not, then let's talk about that best interest, because I think in light of In Re Guardianship of K.R., you know, somewhat recent Supreme Court case, they start to caution courts about this issue, and that best interests may not trump, in all cases, parental preference.
You know, in another case that's a great example, this court recently decided, State on behalf of Liliana L. v. Hugo C., bears a lot of similarity to this case. And I'm going to be very brief so I can get to the best interests as well. But in that case, this court recognized that the negation of the parental preference doctrine is not similar or is not equal to the termination of parental rights, which is much of the legal authority that opposing counsel relies on. And in that case, the father was aware or had some knowledge but did nothing for 4.5 years. The mother died and the court placed custody with the aunt, who was not a biological or adoptive parent, but the court determined that the bonded relationship with that person was sufficient to award custody in the child's best interest.
There are a lot of problems with the dad in that case, though.
There certainly
were.
That
we don't have here.
Correct.
Yeah.
However, the key analysis in that instance with the best interest is the bonded relationship with that family member. That's exactly what we have here. There was an expert testimony from Dr. Leeske, which is very critical, which the district court heavily relied on, that established a bonded relationship with the grandmother and not a bonded relationship with the father. And as you mentioned in your question, the expert testimony is absolutely relevant. Dr. Leeske specifically testified that the child had consistent behavioral problems due to unstable environments or changes in inconsistent routines, and exhibited anxiety and distress whenever she returned from parenting time with her father. Simply put, she stated unequivocally, this is not appropriate at this time. The bonded relationship with the grandmother and the grandmother's role as her caretaker.
At this time, those are words that the district court judge used also,
mm-hmm.
right? That
correct.
At this time, it doesn't make sense to switch custody over to that. But is it really a matter of custody versus having a reasonable transitional parenting schedule to allow this little girl to transition to primarily being with her biological father?
I see that my time has expired. May I answer a question? And it would require a bit of a complex answer. Is that all right? Okay. The timing is certainly a concern, but the main thing here is that by the parental preference doctrine brought it down to them being on equal footing. And so the court was looking at what's in the best interests, bio dad or grandmother. And under that analysis, everything that would be analyzed in a traditional best interest analysis heavily favored the grandmother, the child's stability, her well-being, the primary caretaker, her education and development, her religious upbringing. And very importantly here is Dr. Leeske's testimony that the stability and consistent routines that grandmother provided and that the child indicated the only person she trusted was grandmother. Those are all very important factors weighing in the best interests. The court had to make a determination who should have that custody, and the court analyzed that best interest appropriately and correctly determined it should be with grandmother. Unless there are any other questions?
I do have one more question. Mm-hmm. Is there a third path that the court could have taken? And what I'm speaking of, when I was on a district court judge, sometimes I took this path in a custody situation, is I declined to enter a final order. And when we're talking about whether the child is bonded or not, and particularly under the facts of this case, is the third path, we need to let this situation play out a little longer. We need to keep this in a temporary and see how the relationship develops. Was the court required to make a decision at that point in time that would be a final appealable order and put a permanent order in place?
Your Honor, I don't believe the court was required to. Now, one minor, very minor consideration, of course, is maintaining the timeliness of cases being resolved and things like that, and leaving it open.
Sure.
Also, I think it's valuable for these parties to have some knowledge of where they stand. But I think one of the critical things in relating to Dr. Leeske's testimony is this child needs stability and consistency in her routines. And I think the judge recognized that. He looked at things where we've had a year to test these things out. We've seen how things are going. We haven't had enough significant improvement or development with that relationship with father to merit leaving it out there longer. Essentially, we needed to make a decision in this case so that the child had some stability and routine. And that should things change down the road, that would be appropriate for a modification. As in almost any other custody case, you got to work with the facts you have. And the facts here indicated this was what was necessary and appropriate. The last point, the father was involved with Dr. Leeske. He attended a session in May of 2017, but he went an entire year without being involved with the therapist. That right there, I think, was more than enough for the court to recognize there's not enough progress here for me to merit keeping this open. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time did we take Mr. Little over?
3 minutes.
Would you add 3 minutes to the appellant's rebuttal time, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a couple of things on here briefly that I wanted to try to touch on, and that was first in that In re Liliana case. I do agree with Judge Bishop here that there were several negative aspects of dad that even the counselor had even testified to that were detrimental to the child, effectively, and that does not, that's just not present here in this case. There were, there was also, counsel had touched on the number of years that Mr. Bentley had been absent, and there's two cases out there that also have a period of years specifically, and one of those is the Eric O case, and the other is the Meyer case, spelled M-A-I-R. In the Eric O case, there was no forfeiture decided by the court after 6 years where the child had been in the custody of somebody else with the consent of the dad in that sense. And so the court stated that while we recognize that while the father did not completely perform his parental obligations and could have performed more consistently, the evidence still did not rise to the level to find a forfeiture. In the Meyer case, I know that's one that's not designated for public opinion or review, but they, as far as the dissent in, I believe it was Combs versus O'Neill, had cited to, that case was a 7-year case, and the father had only seen the child one time in the previous 2 years before the trial. And not only that, but he was behind on his child support, and that didn't rise to the level of a forfeiture. So in the sense of whether or not Mr. Bentley has forfeited his parental rights, there's certainly much more egregious cases out there that have not risen to that level, whereas Mr. Bentley, purely because he didn't know.
Mr. Cochran, can you address Mr. Little's assertions in that regard, that, you know, getting the one phone call in October that she was pregnant possibly could be his child? Didn't your client have some responsibility to follow up?
Certainly, Your Honor, I believe that he could have followed up, but as far as he didn't have any contact information from her, there was no evidence to suggest that he knew specifically what her name was in that sense, as far as her full name, just like she may not have known his at the time. The other issue that I think comes into play here is the fact that he was deployed in Iraq. It would have been extremely difficult for him to be able to then turn around and try to do that when he's over potentially fighting in a war.
When
so
he came back to the States, would that have been reasonable?
Certainly it could have been reasonable for him to attempt to try in that sense. I don't know if we should put a burden on him for that when he had no idea that he was the father, that she didn't know he was the father. There's certainly disputed facts as to what happened during their initial phone call. What Mr. Bentley did state was that he was left with the impression that she was pregnant but did not know that the child was his.
On our standard of review, though, don't we have to assume that the court gave more credibility to her testimony, and then we'd have to decide if the, and that credibility determination would be initially for the trial court, and that would be an abuse of discretion for us to reweigh, or not to reweigh it, but we'd have to find it was abuse of discretion in how he handled the credibility question.
Yes, certainly. I think as far as seeing and hearing the witnesses, I know that that's the standard, is that the trial court did see and hear those witnesses. This court didn't necessarily do that, but I do think that necessarily needs to be weighed in the sense of the parental preference doctrine and such a high burden as far as determining whether or not that should overcome any parental preference on the part of Mr. Bentley. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. You are excused, and your case is submitted. Actually, I